This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Dr. John Eastman is a lawyer, a scholar, and also a personal friend. I've known John for years now. We went to the same law school. I did the legal fellowship at the Claremont Institute back in 2018. John led that whole fellowship. We have been friends for a while now. John's life has been put through the ringer since he had the temerity, the chutzpah, to represent an unpopular legal client in late 2020, early 2021. I speak, of course, of the former and perhaps future president of the United States, Donald J. Trump. John took on that most unpopular of causes, that cause that nowadays, more than anything else, will get you the true scarlet letter treatment to be banished from anything remotely resembling polite society. When he stepped into the breach, given all the chaos that was happening in November, December 2020, and said that he will represent this client when it comes to the legal arguments, no matter how unpopular they may be in the eyes of many, that that client wanted to make. Now, taking a step back a bit, John Eastman clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas back in the 1990s. He has written prolifically over the years on any number of constitutional theories. He has been particularly outspoken about the role of the Declaration of Independence in constitutional interpretation. Back in the day, before my former boss on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, Jim Ho, back before he was Judge Jim Ho and was just a prolific attorney, Jim Ho and John Eastman used to go across the country debating 14th Amendment birthright citizenship, another issue that John has been prolific on. He is one of the leading proponents of that particular legal argument, namely that birthright citizenship is not required by the 14th Amendment. My former boss, Judge Ho, disagrees with that one. But everywhere you look, John has been a legal scholar. He was the dean of Chapman Law School, a law school in Orange County, California. Everything started to go into the gutter after John decided to represent Donald Trump. After January 6, 2021, he was forced to retire from Chapman University Law School, the law school, again, where he was dean. Also in 2021, I was living in Colorado at the time. I remember getting dinner with John in Denver because at the time he was a visiting fellow at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He was similarly unceremoniously discharged from Boulder. Most recent, over the past month or two, sources tell me that he has now been debanked from Bank of America and the USAA. They have given him about 30 days to close his banking accounts with them, or else, dot, dot, dot. Who knows? What is this for? All of this is because John Eastman zealously advocated for his legal client the exact same way that I was taught to do so back at the University of Chicago Law School, also John Eastman's alma mater. In the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, and in the events leading up to January 6, 2021, in that most unprecedented of elections where you had the COVID-19 pandemic in the background, you had any number of other states that were doing some legally suspect things when it came to unilaterally deciding to extend mail-in voting and ballot harvesting. You had some very thorny, for lack of a better term, cases out of Pennsylvania and North Carolina, those states that both changed their electoral procedure simply by administrative fiat, not via the legislative process that Article 1 of the Constitution so clearly calls for. There was a lot going on back then. It was uncharted waters for a lot of people. Now, if you believe what the mainstream media tells you, Donald Trump and by extension his chief legal architect, John Eastman, called for the, quote, overturning of the election on January 6, 2021. That's not exactly what happened. In fact, in the aftermath of January 6, 2021, John wrote an essay for Claremont Institute's American Mind website, an essay that has not really gotten the credit that it deserves. In this essay titled Setting the Record Straight on the POTUS Ask, John acquits himself very well as to the actual legal argument that he was advising his client, Donald Trump, to make, and by extension was urging Mike Pence to adopt. It is an argument involving Section 15 of the Electoral Count Act of 1887 and the 12th Amendment. I quote briefly from this essay. Quote, specifically, the relevant language of the 12th Amendment provides that, quote, the president of the Senate, that is the vice president, shall in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives open all the certificates and the votes shall then be counted. The actual counting of the electoral votes is in the passive voice. However, because the only affirmative role conveyed by the active voice to open the certificates is assigned to the vice president, legal scholars and political figures have contended that the counting is assigned to the vice president as well. John was making a 12th Amendment-based case that the vice president has something more than purely ceremonial duties when it comes to deciding whether slates of electors in the Electoral College are legitimate or not, or were so tainted by fraud that they should be kicked back to the states and the state legislatures to consider the possibility of submitting alternative slates of electors. Now, no matter what you might think of that particular argument, the Supreme Court has never weighed in on that question. The United States Supreme Court has never ruled on this actual 12th Amendment argument. That is the exact role of the vice president in the January 6th quadrennial process of counting electoral college votes. They have never ruled on that. It is an issue of first impression, to use the relevant legal language. That in and of itself, and John cites other legal scholars in this essay, many of whom have openly conceded that it is a viable, non-frivolous argument. But that fact in and of itself makes it well within the bounds of what a lawyer can properly do when he is zealously advocating for his client. Notwithstanding the fact, the latest attempt to persecute John Eastman, who's already being tried as a criminal co-defendant in Fannie Willis's prosecution in Georgia involving Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants. He's being prosecuted there along with other attorneys like former DOJ official Jeffrey Clark and Rudy Giuliani himself. The latest is the State Bar of California, a 128-page ruling about a week and a half ago from Judge Yvette Roland, issuing a recommendation to disbar John Eastman, to strip him of his law license. The former dean of a law school there, a former United States Supreme Court clerk, a prolific legal scholar. This from Judge Roland. Quote, the court rejects Eastman's contention that this disciplinary proceeding and Eastman's resultant discipline is motivated by his political views or his representation of President Trump. Rather, his wrongdoing constitutes exceptionally serious ethical violations warranting severe professional discipline. Says who? Says who? What are we trying to do to the legal profession in this country? We are currently prosecuting it in the state of Georgia for Jeffrey Clark, John Eastman, Rudy Giuliani. Jeffrey Clark is having his law license disbarred by the Washington, D.C. bar. John Eastman's having his California bar disbarred out in California. All for the high crime and misdemeanor, the chutzpah, of zealously advocating for their clients' legal arguments the exact same way that once upon a time, and I only graduated law school 8 years ago, that once upon a time, every single law student who took legal ethics, an ABA-required law school course. That's what every law student once upon a time learned to do. And all of this collectively amounts to a war on the legal profession. Once upon a time, the left understood this. They understood the imperative of defending unpopular clients. Back when those unpopular clients were the NAACP, marching for civil rights down in Selma, Alabama, Montgomery, all that, the left understood perfectly well the imperative of being able to take on unpopular clients in the eyes of some and doing a good job as an attorney. Apparently nowadays, when the client's name is not called the NAACP, but the client's name is Donald J. Trump, or insert your other right-wing boogeyman of the day, apparently the calculus is flipped entirely on its head. I'm proud to call John Eastman a friend. He is a good man. You might disagree with his constitutional interpretation of the 12th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, whatever. It doesn't matter. The day that this country decides to criminally prosecute and disbar lawyers simply for engaging in the practice of law is the day that this country ceases to be a serious first world republic and just goes further and further down the drain of sub-Saharan African tyranny.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
As it has often been said, war is hell. And the fact that war is hell is part of the reason why you don't make war in the first place if you can help it at all. Everyone hates war. War is bloody. It is gruesome. It tears countries apart. Sometimes it is necessary. Sometimes there is obviously such thing as a just war. A defensive war would be the number one example of that. Whether it was the United States declaring war on Japan after Pearl Harbor, or whether it is Israel declaring war against the Hamas jihadist organization after their rough equivalent of Pearl Harbor, 9/11, some combination thereof, which would be October 7th, 2023. But when war is hell, things happen in war zones. It's a freaking war zone. It's not going to go according to the carefully devised strategies of tacticians. It's not going to be a chessboard perfectly moving the pieces here. It's a war zone. And the most recent incident in Gaza that is just a reminder of the hellish nature of war and the nature of war zones in general, but it's which is really throwing people all over the world, very much including here in the United States, up in arms, was this tragic killing this past week of 7 aid workers for the World Central Kitchen organization. So the World Central Kitchen was founded in 2010 by Jose Andres. He is a chef. I guess you would call him an entrepreneur. He's also a total left-winger. He is a bleeding heart liberal of a left-winger, someone who apparently has no compunctions whatsoever about sending his own aid workers into war zones and into harm's way. And because this is a war zone, and because accidents tragically do happen in war zones, the IDF accidentally took out a convoy in what should have been a deconflicted zone for the 7 aid workers, one of whom is a dual U.S.-Canadian national, so a U.S. citizen. Now, there's a lot of questions to be raised here. You had the usual suspects on social media saying that, oh, the Jews are just innocently slaughtering people again, all the various blood libels that tragically have just burst out from the sewers of the internet right out into the open since October 7, 2023. You've seen no shortage of that. The slightly more sophisticated version than just saying they deliberately targeted them, which, to be clear, we have seen. The slightly more sophisticated version just says that this is just more and more examples of the IDF and the Israeli military and special ops in general just being completely careless and reckless. Even if they're not intentional murderers, they are just not taking the precautions necessary to fight a war like this. Well, at Newsweek, where I work, we've published at least three op-eds now from a guy by the name of John Spencer. John Spencer is the head of urban warfare at West Point. He was there in Iraq during the ISIS counterinsurgency in Mosul in 2016. He's been studying urban warfare for decades. And in the op-eds of his that we have published, and across any number of other media as well, John Spencer has repeatedly said that Israel's war in Gaza is the most just and humanitarian war that any army he has ever studied has ever fought in an urban setting. The ratio of civilian to militant deaths is orders of magnitude lower than even America's counterinsurgency against ISIS in Mosul in 2016. That is not to say, again, that tragic mistakes do not happen. But the people that are so, I mean, not just lamenting the fact that there is tragic, innocent loss of life. It is tragic. It's horrible. It is unambiguously horrible. And Prime Minister Netanyahu and all the various IDF generals have been the first to admit that this is a tragic mistake. They are investigating it from the top down. They're trying to figure out what happened. Why did they mistake them for possible armed combatants? That's all being handled. But the people that are going above and beyond and are saying that this is evidence of massive war crimes and starving the population and to take it to its logical conclusion, then you have people that are saying that Israel is perpetrating the very Holocaust on these people that the Jews were perpetrated against by the Nazis. I mean, disgusting Holocaust inversion. The people saying that have simply lost touch with reality. They are holding the IDF to a literal standard of perfection that no military, again, can possibly match. And John Spencer, the West Point urban warfare guy, says that they are doing a better job than literally any army based on a civilian to militant death ratio that any army in the history of urban warfare he has ever studied has actually achieved. As for Jose Andres himself, he appears to be a blithering moron. He has indeed said that Israel, quote, deliberately targeted the workers there in Gaza. He is saying that Israel's war in Gaza is, quote, not a war against terrorism anymore, but a, quote, war against humanity itself. Are you out of your everlasting mind? Sir, I understand why you are sad. I am sad, too, that innocent people have lost their lives. But you as a celebrity chef, in order to score publicity points with the liberal media and with the Western world in general, you took it upon yourself to actively send these people into a war zone in the first place. As for a war against humanity itself, have you read about what happened on October 7, 2023? The burning babies in ovens, the mass raping of women, the genital mutilations, the murder of Holocaust survivors in their own homes, execution style? Have you read about this? Well, as it turns out, Jose Andres is just an idiot leftist. He's actually been accusing Israel of targeting hospitals and civilians for many months now. He actually called for a ceasefire on October 13th, less than a week after October 7th. So again, this is a tragic accident. The point is that it is a war zone. And if you are someone who is in a position of power and decision-making where you are debating whether to send people into a war zone, even if the intention is to do good, maybe you should think twice about doing so, because war is hell and good things are not always going to happen, even with the very best of intentions.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Joe Biden is catastrophically unpopular. His approval rating, based on the Real Clear Politics polling average, is 14 to 15 points underwater. When you go to specific issues, inflation, immigration, he's getting 30 points or more underwater. Definitely when you want to talk about the issues that independent voters say they care about, that the median American says he cares about, immigration, crime, inflation, the economy, really those issues. If the election this fall is going to be fought on those grounds, then Joe Biden is in very bad shape. He is in for a world of hurt. As the ancient Chinese military theorist and strategist Sun Tzu famously said, a battle is won before it is fought. It is won by choosing the terrain on which it is fought. And for that very reason, I am staunchly of the opinion that Trump and all Republicans, for the matter, must make sure, to the best of their abilities, that the election this fall is contested on the substantive issues that matter to the median American, namely those issues I just said: immigration, crime, the economy, and inflation. In general, global sanity, whether the world should be up in flames or not. You keep it to those issues, you're probably going to be in good shape. The problem is that it might not happen. Joe Biden, the DNC, and a lot of allied forces are going to try really, really hard. They already are. To make the election this fall about other issues that they believe play much more to their strengths. There is no issue that Democrats currently believe play more to their strengths than the abortion issue. And it pains me as a staunch pro-lifer to say that they are not necessarily wholly wrong for thinking that. In the aftermath of the Dobbs decision in June 2022, which overturned Roe v. Wade and brought the issue of abortion back to we the people, the left and the pro-abortion side has won every single time this question has been directly brought before the people in a state referendum. August 2022, about a month and a half after the Dobbs case, was in Deep Red, Kansas, and the pro-abortion side won an admittedly confusingly worded ballot referendum, but they won there by about a 59 to 41 margin. There have been similar results in Kentucky, Michigan, and perhaps most recently in Ohio last November. Issue one in Ohio last November, that passed. The pro-abortion side won by about a 57 to 43 margin. So it is huge news amidst all that context that the Florida Supreme Court this past Monday, on the one hand, they had a great ruling for us pro-lifers. By a 6-1 margin, the Florida Supreme Court held that the Florida state constitution does not contain a so-called right to privacy that would guarantee a state constitutional right to abortion. And in doing so, the Florida Supreme Court paved the way for the 15-week abortion ban that Florida passed 2 years ago in 2022. And if you remember last year, you'll recall that Florida actually passed a subsequent 6-week abortion ban. There was a trigger mechanism which basically said that if the 15-week ban were upheld, the 6-week ban goes into effect 1 month later. So all of that is to say that come May 1st here in the state of Florida, there's going to be a 6-week abortion ban, which from a pro-life perspective is a tremendous victory. That is a heartbeat bill because the current state of embryology of fetal science informs us that unborn children develop a beating heart at right around 6 weeks gestational period. Here's where it gets more complicated. It gets more complicated because the same day that the Florida Supreme Court decided that, they also ruled in a 4-3 split decision to allow a pro-abortion ballot initiative to go forward and to be voted on in up-down fashion by we the people in Florida this fall. That ballot initiative would, at a bare minimum, legalize abortion up until so-called viability, which is vaguely defined as the ability of the unborn child to live outside the womb absent medical care. That is a morally arbitrary and scientifically and medically constantly shifting and changing point. It's meaningless, but we pretended with Roe versus Wade back in 73 that it was meaningful. It is meaningless. The Florida ballot initiative would, at minimum, legalize abortion up until that, but like so many other examples, the so-called health exception is so strong in the ballot initiative in Florida that it would have the effect of essentially legalizing abortion probably right up until birth if you can get a doctor to sign off that the mother is so mentally distressed over this. It was a 4-3 decision. You had some justices dissenting, but it's a very big deal. On the same day, incidentally, the Florida Supreme Court also greenlit a separate ballot initiative for recreational marijuana legalization as well. Now, the silver lining in the state of Florida is that a 50+1 majority is not sufficient. So, for example, in Ohio, when Issue 1 passed 57-43, a big abortion victory for the pro-abortion side last November in Ohio, an increasingly red state, that margin would not pass in Florida. You need 60%. And there's going to be a ton of money flooding into our state. Not just because it's a large state, but there's going to be a ton of money flooding in from the pro-life side, from the pro-abortion side. All of that raises the question as to whether Florida, because of the Sun Tzu quote and the idea of the terrain shifting, if the Democrats can really hype up this abortion thing here in Florida, does that possibly put the state of Florida in play? And I think the answer to that question is very simple. No. No, it doesn't. If you look at the data, when Ron DeSantis beat Andrew Gillum in the 2018 Florida gubernatorial race by 0.4 percentage points, the same year that Rick Scott won his Senate race by an even smaller margin, 0.1 or something like that. At that time, Democrats in Florida had a roughly 250,000 voter registration advantage. It was about a D plus 250,000 advantage. Fast forward till today, that has shifted by about 1 million voters. Republicans in Florida now have about a 700,000 to 800,000 voter registration advantage. That is an astonishing shift, an absolutely astonishing shift, unprecedented in modern political history anywhere in the United States that I'm aware of. So the short answer is that no, Florida is not going to be in play this fall for Democrats. Now, I am definitely worried about the actual ballot initiatives themselves. Again, the 60% threshold is cause for solace. But we certainly cannot rest on our laurels. Florida is an increasingly red state, but it is not exactly Oklahoma or South Dakota when it comes to being an evangelical or a Bible Belt state either. So we're going to have to fight to make sure that our pro-life laws stay on the books here in Florida. Ultimately, we should not have to do so. The idea of ballot initiatives in general, frankly, is garbage. It is often said that America is not a democracy, it is a constitutional republic. That quote, trite though it may seem, has the distinct benefit of being profoundly true. We don't decide pressing questions in this country in top-down, democratic, majoritarian, mobocracy fashion. We appeal them through we decide them through specific legislative deliberative processes. When Stephen Douglas spoke of popular sovereignty in 1858 against Abraham Lincoln, he was getting at this point. But we remember Lincoln, not Douglas, from those debates. We remember his appeals to substantive justice and natural law. I hope and I pray that Florida continues to be a bastion in the pro-life fight, and ballot initiatives in general ought to meet the ash heap of history.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's Hammer Time.
Harvard University to offer segregated graduation ceremonies based on race, class, and sexuality. Harvard is apparently planning to hold more graduation ceremonies than I even thought possible. They're holding a separate one for disability. They're holding a separate one for global indigenous. No matter what intersectional slice of the pie you fall into, whether it is Pacific Islander or first generation low income, you're going to have your own graduation ceremony at Harvard. You know, back in the day, you know, Oprah Winfrey, you get a car, you get a car. Well, at Harvard, apparently in the year 2024, you get a graduation ceremony and you get a graduation ceremony. And the university is also holding a central ceremony for students of all backgrounds, but on the side, they're offering all of this. Well, Harvard apparently has learned absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. This university, arguably the most famous in the entire world, was just put through the ringer for months on end over the trials and tribulations of its own woke-addled administration. Didn't we just have a few months ago the idiotic affirmative action hire of an ex-president, Claudine Gay, the woman who has written precisely 10 journal articles and zero books whatsoever, who was made the president of Harvard due solely to her skin color? Didn't we just have her shambolic testimony before the United States Congress about failing to condemn calls for the genocide of Jews on our campus, and then her resignation a few weeks later after her plagiarism came out? Didn't we just go through this? Harvard, are you going to learn anything whatsoever or not? Apparently, they're doubling down on wokeism. I cannot say I'm surprised. The Bill Ackmans of the world notwithstanding, you simply did not have enough high-profile Harvard alums who came out in the aftermath of L'affaire Claudine Gay to condemn what had happened. Unfortunately, it's going to take much more of a grassroots uprising. At the end of the day, when universities like this pull these kind of stunts, it should be an unambiguous signal to folks like me and to folks like you. They do not want us there. That is not a hospitable place for us and our values. And you know what our solution to be? Don't go. Just don't go. It's really not a whole lot more difficult than that. The University of Texas, meanwhile, is shutting down its DEI bureaucracy. Specifically, the administrators are closing down their DEI division. They're requiring some DEI deans to return to teaching, and they are eliminating other DEI positions altogether. A ton of credit here goes to Chris Rufo, the investigative journalist and a previous guest on this show, who did yeoman's work last year exposing the depth of the depravity of DEI on public university campuses in the state of Texas. In fact, it is highly likely that without that investigative journalism groundwork, that Texas and its legislature would not have taken the actions that it ultimately took in order to shut down DEI. Now, a lot of folks at UT Austin's campus were trying, Texas's legislation notwithstanding, to get around and to say that it actually didn't apply to them, and that, oh, they're not actually DEI, they're more legal or at least arguably more legal race conscious or diversity administrators. But when the rule of law speaks clearly, and the Texas legislature spoke fairly clearly on this, as did the Florida legislature and an increasing number of red states, then ultimately they were going to have to follow, and the University of Texas has indeed done so. Texas is an interesting state because you have this flagship public university, UT Austin, there in the city of Austin, which is a very blue, very, very blue city, if you know Austin, if you know Travis County, Texas at all. And UT Austin is a very liberal university, but Austin is also home to something a bit more powerful than the University of Texas. That would be the Texas State Legislature. And this whole tempest in a teapot And the victorious results that the forces of civilizational sanity have now had there in Austin over the forces of civilizational arson, this whole result is just a very, very, very effective reminder that when you are in a state like Texas, a red state, and you have a majority or a supermajority in your legislature, go ahead and use that power. The people gave you that power for a reason. Do not shy away from actually wielding it and implementing it. Here, the students at the University of Texas are going to be the chief beneficiaries of Texas's willingness to use political power. Tony Blinken has appointed a chief diversity and inclusion officer at the U.S. Department of State. This is after a 10-month vacancy. So who's the lucky winner? Zakiya Carr Johnson. She's going to serve as the next chief diversity and inclusion officer. She co-founded the Black Women Disrupt Initiative. I don't pretend to know exactly what that means. I guess we're talking about people here who kind of come in and just disrupt the status quo. So maybe if you're talking about kind of the patriarchy of the white penis people, then maybe getting a black woman in there is good for disruption on its own sake here. I guess the real question is, apparently this job was held vacant for 10 months. Did anyone notice? I mean, were people really walking around foggy bottom at the U.S. State Department and looking at their colleague and saying, oh my God, when are they going to fill this vacancy? I mean, there's a war going on in Gaza. There's a war going on in Ukraine. China might invade Taiwan at any moment. The Wagner Group of Vladimir Putin is sowing all sorts of discord in sub-Saharan Africa. Oh, by the way, Maduro down in Venezuela is possibly invading an oil field in French Guiana next door. We have China making further inroads in Cuba. But man, what I really care about is whether or not we're going to get a chief diversity hire here at the U.S. Department of State. The whole thing is just, I mean, it really defies words. I mean, there are only so many words that you can use to describe this kind of intense fealty, this kind of loyalty to a dogma. That is what it is. It is a dogma. It is a blind faith and an ideology at this point. Unfortunately, Tony Blinken, who is a purportedly smart man, someone who has gone to many of the nation's greatest universities, he is someone who in theory very much should know better. Tragically, he does not. We are seeing that play out over and over again over the past few months in the war in Gaza. Tony Blinken himself, who is he's the son and the grandson and the relative of Holocaust survivors, he has been tragically flipping that entire conflict in Gaza on its head in an absolutely shameful sense. And here he is right here at Foggy Bottom, once again, playing the identity card above all else, because in order to be a Democrat in good standing, that means playing the intersectional Olympics the best you possibly can. Wisconsin's Democratic governor vetoes transgender athlete ban. So this is a bill that Wisconsin's Republican-led legislature passed. It would have required Wisconsin public and private schools to designate participation in high school sports based on their student athletes' sex assigned at birth, as opposed to their gender identity. This has been popular legislation. At least 24 states since 2020 have enacted similar laws categorically banning so-called transgender athletes from competing on the teams like this. Nonetheless, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, Governor Evers, has gone ahead and vetoed this particular piece of legislation. Doesn't seem like Republicans have the votes to mount a successful veto override. And that's unfortunate, because this, based on the polling, is like a 70-30, 75-25 issue. This is still an issue where the forces of civilizational sanity are prevailing against the forces of civilizational arson. And it doesn't take much more than pure common sense to realize this. Anyone who has ever watched any kind of sporting event, we've all seen those graphics, and it's very much one of those picture, or in this case, video tells a thousand words kind of scenarios of Lydia Thomas, the transgender University of Pennsylvania swimmer a few years ago. We saw Thomas just dominating Riley Gaines and all the other biological females that he was competing against there. And that really shocked a lot of people and woke a lot of people up. This is not a popular issue for Democrats in purple states like Wisconsin. They might think that it is. It really is not. But because you have the far left of the Democratic Party, that even though they represent a relatively small minority, of the cultural extreme, whether it is the transgender issue, whether it is open borders, whether it is Hamas, They represent a very small minority of the broader American political spectrum, but they are so loud and they are frankly so obnoxious that you have time and time again elected officials and other officials, whether it is Tony Blinken at the State Department or whether it is Governor Tony Evers in the state of Wisconsin, who are just utterly capitulating. God willing, they are going to pay for that. They will feel the repercussions of that in Wisconsin, which is one of the seven crucial swing states going to the ballots this November. Finally, Arizona State University professor is suing over mandatory diversity training. So Owen Anderson, who has devoted 21 years to teaching philosophy and religious studies at Arizona State, he is instigating a legal action against Arizona State over a mandatory diversity training program. He has described it as a form of compelled speech that assigns blame based on race in violation of Arizona State law. Well, Professor Anderson is 100% right about this. Mandatory diversity training, DEI training, whatever you want to call it, the entire point of this is to assign various intersectional identities, whether it is white, brown, black, country of origin, sexual identities, any of the intersectional pie, is to say that some of you are oppressors, some of you are oppressed. Therefore, there is systemic oppression from the oppressors to the oppressed. That is the whole point of modern critical theory, of modern wokeism, intersectionality, whatever you want to call it. By the way, you want one person who has actually recently come out against mandatory diversity training and mandatory DEI statements of allegiance? Randall Kennedy, who is a longtime, decades-long liberal Harvard Law School professor. He had a fascinating op-ed in Harvard's student newspaper the other day. Quote, mandatory DEI statements are ideological pledges of allegiance. Time to abandon them. That really caught me by surprise. I had thought that Professor Kennedy was a bit more of a wokester. I'm actually debating Randall Kennedy this Thursday in a debate up at Harvard, which should be a lot of fun. But if even he is saying that mandatory diversity training and DEI diversity statements of allegiance, if even he is saying that this is compelled speech and is un-American, then we are on the right side of this issue. Just keep the pedal to the metal. More Americans, the more these stories come out, are ultimately coming out in favor of our position. For the time being, though, I do wish Owen Anderson the best of luck in this particular proceeding out in Arizona. He's being represented by the Goldwater Institute. I hope that he prevails. I expect that he probably will prevail as well.